KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
If the Supreme Court asks me, or my attorney general or a solicitor general, do we think that meets constitutional muster, I felt it was important for us to answer that question honestly, and the answer is no.
My book says that creativity is the source of all economic wealth. And I don't mean just in software and biotech. I mean in a pair of eyeglasses. I mean in the tie or the suit jacket you wear.
If you think you are the greatest sufferer in the world, ask my daughter, Akwini, how many twins she has born and thrown away.
Today on Weekday, we'll remember the novelist Chinua Achebe. He was reading there from his novel, Things Fall Apart. Also, we'll talk about the creative class. Richard Florida was talking about the importance of creativity in a city's growth. We'll take a look at how well those ideas have played out. And President Obama talking about California's ban on gay marriage. I'm Steve Scherr. This is Weekday. This week, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in two cases that may reshape the country's legal opinion on same-sex marriage. On Tuesday, justices will consider California's Proposition 8 law that bans same-sex marriage in that state. On Wednesday, they'll hear arguments on DOMA, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And how will either of these rulings affect Washington State's legalization of same-sex marriage? Marcia Coyle covers the Supreme Court as chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Review. Marcia Coyle, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
What do you expect to hear from the justices tomorrow? What are the ways the questions might go?
Well, tomorrow's case poses one question for the justices. The justices are being asked whether the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution allows California to define marriage as between a man and a woman. So the justices are going to be asking the lawyers for both sides of in the Proposition 8 case, what is it about the definition of marriage here that either violates the Equal Protection Clause or doesn't? And so they're going to be talking about how gays and lesbians are viewed as a class. The Equal Protection Clause offers certain protections to classes of people, people who've been classified, for example, by race, sex, national origin, and it offers different levels of protection from government action taken against those what we call suspect classes. And so we expect that they're going to be probing the history of the gay rights movement to see if gays are politically powerful, history of discrimination against gays, to see if they need special protection under the Equal Protection Clause. And also they're going to be asking the lawyers who are supporting Proposition 8, defending Proposition 8, what is it about the definition of marriage that if it were to encompass gay couples would be harmful? So I think it's going to be a broad-ranging argument. And then secondarily, and it's almost equally important, there's another issue in the Prop 8 case, and it's very similar to a secondary issue in the DOMA case, and that has to do with the group that is defending Proposition 8 in the Supreme Court and whether they have what we call standing to actually defend the proposition. This group has to show the court that it has a particular interest that gives it legitimacy to defend Proposition 8, that it would suffer an injury if Proposition 8 were struck down. So that's a very serious question for the Supreme Court and all federal courts. You can't just bring a lawsuit and claim that you have a right to sue somebody. you have to show that you've been injured and that the court can remedy that injury. So the Supreme Court and all federal courts, that's almost like a threshold question. Do you have a right to be standing before us? So that's also going to be explored with the lawyers on both sides.
You know,
I expect it to be a fascinating argument, Steve.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the standing issue, how does the court justify, is the court grouping these two arguments, these two cases, the one about Proposition 8 and the one about DOMA, how are they seeing them as tied?
I think they actually are quite different, but they're tied together, obviously, because they involve how marriage is being defined here, and how the federal law and Proposition 8 exclude a group of people from that definition. So they're tied in that sense. Also, how the court decides to examine the constitutional question in both cases, what kind of scrutiny is it going to bring to bear? It could really result in other ramifications for other states in how they either define marriage or don't, whether they allow gay marriages or don't. The cases are tied in that sense, even though they arise under very different legal grounds. For example, as I said, the Prop 8 case arises under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, and the DOMA case, because it involves federal action, arises under the Equal Protection Guarantee of the Fifth Amendment. So. They're different, and the standing issues are different, but they obviously have at their core how the court is going to view marriage, and marriage is the fundamental right that the court has recognized in our Constitution.
I was reading some commentary that said, I think this was this weekend, that said that the court could make a broad ruling here, or make a very narrow ruling, and that some people argued that a narrow ruling would be better because it's better to lay the groundwork for these shifts in culture. And they were pointing back to Roe v. Wade, arguing that Roe v. Wade took too far a leap.
Right, Steve. That's very much in play in the Proposition 8 case, and also in the DOMA case, this sense that this is an issue best left to the states to resolve. Marriage has always been the prerogative of the states in terms of, you know, what's required in order to be married. And so why not leave it to the states? It's their prerogative. States are moving to deal with it. Stay out of it, basically. That is an argument that's being made. And the court could accept that argument or not. But it's just one of several arguments you're going to hear from those who are supporting Proposition 8 as well as supporting the Defense of Marriage Act. Leave it to the states.
Marcia Coyle covers the Supreme Court as chief correspondent for the National Law Journal. What were you saying, Marcia? I interrupted you.
I was going to say there are so many different ways the court could go in these two cases, and there are probably ways that constitutional law experts haven't even thought of. So I'm not sure, you know, really what the court will do here. And that's why the arguments are going to be so fascinating. You can't judge really how the court's going to decide a case on the basis of oral arguments, because the justices are so good at playing devil's advocate with each side. But I do think you get a sense of, you know, what they're going to focus on, you know, what their concerns are. So that's what we're all going to be listening for. And your listeners, too, are going to be able to hear it, because the court is releasing same-day audio of the arguments. And something else I'd like to tell you, it's really interesting. Over the weekend, people began lining up outside of the court building, hoping to get a seat inside. And I think the Supreme Court police are preparing for huge crowds, as well as some demonstrations over the next 2 days.
When the court hears the DOMA case, It's a very specific case about 83-year-old Edith Windsor.
Yes, and she was legally married and to her partner, who is dead. Edith Windsor's now a widow, and her spouse left her estate to Edith Windsor. And under the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which defines marriage as the union of a man and a woman for all federal purposes, Edith Windsor had to pay estate taxes of almost $400,000 on the estate that her spouse left her because of the federal law not recognizing her marriage, even though her marriage is legally recognized. I think they first were married in Canada, and then were the marriage was recognized by the state of New York. So the issue before the court in the DOMA case is whether the DOMA law violates the constitutional rights, the equal protection guarantee to same-sex couples who are legally married. And there are over 1,000 federal laws that look to the definition of marriage in terms of giving benefits, taxes. So it's a very broad law that affects gay couples who are legally married. So the court could just decide in DOMA that the law discriminates against gay couples who are legally married in their states. It doesn't have to say anything broader than that, although it could.
Then it takes us back to the Prop 8 ruling.
Yes.
What impact could the Prop 8 ruling have on states like Washington, where gay marriage is now legal?
Well, it depends on how broadly, how narrowly the Supreme Court rules. If the court were to say that the question again in Prop 8 is whether California can define marriage as between a man and a woman, and if the court were to say, no, you can't, then states that prohibit, or if it issues a broad ruling like that, that a state can't define marriage as between a man and a woman, then the states that have bans against gay marriage would be in trouble, and those bans likely would fall. But in states that actually legalized gay marriage, I don't believe that a ruling saying that California can define marriage as between a man and a woman would have any impact on the state of Washington, because it would really be up to Washington voters then if it wanted to change its law on gay marriage. But right now, there are nine states in the District of Columbia that permit gay marriage, and I don't believe those laws are in any jeopardy.
Of course, it takes them, when someone moves to another state there that where it's banned, their marriage is not seen as legal in that state's eyes. How does that,
that's
be affected?
That's problematic if the court were to say that California can define marriage as between a man and a woman. Couples who are legally married in their own states and move to another state might have a real problem having those marriages recognized for state purposes, and we'll have to see what the court does with the federal law as well. So it's complicated, and I know the court will probably be thinking about all these potential ramifications. And the bottom line is that in both cases, they could avoid these questions because of the standing problems that are in both cases, and just not rule on the merits.
Well, you have an interesting week ahead, and then they rule, and then they'll give us their decision later. Marcia Coyle, thank you.
My pleasure. Take care now.
Take care. Marcia Coyle covers the Supreme Court. She's the chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. Tomorrow and Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments on California's Prop 8 law that bans same-sex marriage. And on Wednesday, they'll hear arguments on DOMA, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. This is Weekday.
919. How important is the so-called creative class to the vitality of American cities? We'll take that up in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic, providing a variety of fresh organic fruits and vegetables, now featuring three new organic farm boxes, small, medium, and grande, to match the needs of small to large families. Information and delivery at Zaarly, ZAARLY.com/Tiny's Organic.
47 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Forecast says expect sun through the day with an afternoon high of 60. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. We'll take a look back at the life and work of acclaimed Nigerian author Chinua Achebe in 20 minutes.
Now we're going to take a look first, as Bernard was saying, as the creative class. How's it done? Or as we titled it, Creative Class Dismissed. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scheer. More than a decade ago, Richard Florida's best-selling book, The Rise of the Creative Class, was something of a cultural phenomenon. It laid out the argument that members of the so-called creative class, young, educated, single folks, gays, will reinvent American cities and encourage cities to invest in arts and culture and nightlife to attract these creative types, to change their zoning, to make sure that there could be street life. Some critics say the wealth of the creative class hasn't really trickled down to the working class. Among those critics, Richard Florida himself said it hadn't worked out the way he had thought in terms of that trickle down. Some places, like Tacoma, used Richard Florida's ideas as a blueprint for reinventing their downtowns. Other places have continued to turn to the exurbs and the suburbs, where housing is cheaper and where development can use the land that's cheaper. Joel Kotkin is a presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University. He's a contributing editor to the City Journal. He's author of The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. And he recently wrote an article for the Daily Beast talking about Richard Florida's creative class model and how it hasn't worked. Joel Kotkin, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
In a nutshell, what's your argument for why the creative class model hasn't worked?
Well, as I pointed out in the piece, and I've been writing for quite a long time, and Richard and I have even debated on this, I think in a limited series of circumstances, in particular places, you could make the case that, well, you attract these hip young people and good things happen, you know, particularly for real estate developers. And I think there's some truth to that in certain places, but where I really took Richard to task is when he was out there going to Elmira and working class cities, and even to some extent Tacoma, because I've been to Tacoma, and sort of suggesting, well, here's the formula, and you do this, everything will work out fine. And of course, he himself has to admit that didn't happen. There are other forces that create more prosperous cities, and there are different forms that takes in different places. Every place has its own kind of DNA. Seattle area, which I've studied quite a bit, is, you know, sort of unique because it has, for instance, low cost electricity, which is a big deal. It has major manufacturers as well as a strong tech sector. It's a really quite unique situation. There are many other places that may have, let's say, the tech sector or the culture industries, but not the manufacturing and not the sort of tangible economy that helps more working class people. So I think there was a problem which was trying to take a template, which was probably appropriate in a handful of places in this country, and try to essentially sell it as a solution to the vast and very, very heterodox realities of American cities.
Let me listen to with you a little bit of Richard Florida on this program in 2003 describing the creative class.
Well, my book says is that creativity is the source of all economic wealth. And I don't mean just in software and biotech. I mean in a pair of eyeglasses. I mean in the tie or the suit jacket you wear or those appliances in your kitchen. Every product that we use in our society is increasingly the value when it comes from the creativity, the design, the cultural and innovative component of that product. So the creative class is important not because of its lifestyle. The lifestyle is going to change and it's just an accoutrement. The creative class is important because, like the working class, it is the driving economic force in our society.
Now, narrowly, what do you take issue with that argument?
Well, first of all, of course, it's an appealing idea, particularly to those of us who actually make our living doing, in the media where we, at least we think we're creative. But here's where I would defer. Creativity can be applied to something that creates, you know, fundamentally little economic value. Let's say a performance artist on the streets of Seattle. Now, you know, maybe it creates a little bit. It's very creative, but probably doesn't do much economically. On the other hand, an engineer working for a natural gas company that's finding ways of getting natural gas into the economy is going to have a massive effect. Somebody working in agriculture or manufacturing, an engineer at Boeing, those people are going to have a greater effect. So technology and creativity, its effect is really tied to what the actual effect of it is. In other words, a French sociologist once talked about technology is applying new ways to do old things. And that kind of creativity can have an enormous effect globally as well as regionally. But not all creativity, if you will, is created equal and has the same effect as other creativity. I mean, some creativity is, you know, you have surplus wealth in a given society, and you know, you have, let's say, an artistic expression of that. Well, you know, that's probably useful. Now, where I live in Los Angeles, we have creativity, sometimes not very good creativity, but it does generate value because people pay a lot of money for it. So it really, you know, I think you really have to think more about the activity itself and what it does than just sort of say, well, all creativity is what drives everything, because, you know, fundamentally, it depends where that creativity is applied.
Now, Joel Kotkin, in criticism of your own work and in the work that you've done, people say, well, Joel Kotkin, he is just, whereas Richard Florida is trying to reinvigorate the Rust Belt cities and the downtowns and density, Joel Kotkin's argument is for cheap land, cheap houses, Houston, low land rule and regulation, so that people can build and expand out into the cheapest areas, and that is where economic growth comes from. And is that a simplified version of your belief?
Well, of course it is. And you know, first of all, you know, I live in the densest urban region in the United States, which happens to be Los Angeles. If you take the whole region put together, you know, New York is dense in parts, but actually quite low density in the vast expanses of it. No, what I really look at is that you have to have various different environments, and they will mostly be created organically in order to have a really healthy area. So if you suggest, well, the only thing you can have is exurbs and suburbs, and which I've never said, well, that would be limiting because there are some people, it's, you know, maybe 10-15% of the population would rather have a high-density environment. But what we see more now is an attempt to say, no, everybody has to live in high density. We're not going to build any more single-family homes. Well, the problem with that is, as people grow up, I mean, one of the fundamental arguments Richard and I have had is his creative class does something really weird. It grows up, and people start getting into their 30s, and they start thinking about maybe they want to buy a house, maybe they're going to get married, maybe they're going to have children. And their tastes about what they want begin to change as they get older. Not everyone is Peter Pan. And so I think that that's really where I see things. Now, like, for instance, you take a place like Houston, which, you know, I think is probably the most exciting city in America in terms of what's going on economically. Well, you have some of the most advanced development of medium and even somewhat high density inside what they call the 610 loop, because the economy is growing. And you also have a lot of development in the exurbs and the suburbs. So I think you can have both. I mean, when I was in Seattle about a year and a half ago, and I was speaking actually at the Police Foundation banquet, but I spent the day, you know, talking with the officers in the Seattle Police Department. I was very hard pressed to find anyone. I think perhaps maybe the chief lived in Seattle, but almost all of them lived in the outer suburbs of Seattle. If you didn't have that option, it would be very difficult to have a police force.
Right, and this has been the argument that even Florida agrees with. He has said that, here's what we found, he wrote in his article, where he said, I didn't abandon my creative class notion. A high share of skills, creativity, knowledge lifts the wages of every class or group of workers in a city, creative, service, blue collar alike. But even though wages go up for everybody, but housing costs become the tipping point for people that can't afford to live in urban areas. Is there, and of course there's an environmental argument here as well, right? So, and let's get to that in a moment, but is there a way that the creative class notion works, but we have this fundamental problem of the housing stock?
Well, you know, again, I would say that you have to, you know, using the creative class, you know, if you're going to say, well, we're, you know, how do you define the creative class? I mean, for instance, you would have the creative class, is it anyone with a college degree, which is sort of the broadest group, you know, about 30% of the workforce. Well, you know, the accountant who has a college degree and lives in suburban Atlanta and is a, you know, church-growing evangelical Christian probably isn't the same as a single graphic artist living in Soho. I mean, because basically part of the whole creative class idea is there's a set of sort of commonly shared beliefs. Well, I think when you get to such a large group of people, there's an enormous diversity in those views. So, I mean, I think that again, I think we make the mistake of sort of having this sort of one template as being the only one that matters. And look, Richard himself is not particularly interested in the manufacturing sector, not particularly interested in warehousing, not particularly interested in agriculture, and obviously in fossil fuel energy. So, you know, all those industries are sort of, you know, not part of his equation. And the problem is, when you have an economy which is deindustrialized or is deindustrializing, that also creates less opportunity for working class and middle class people. And so I think you have to look at how do you do a lot of different things at the same time. And, you know, it's interesting in our studies of STEM growth and manufacturing growth, the two places that stand out creating lots of STEM jobs and lots of manufacturing are Houston and Seattle, which are an unlikely pairing, to say the least.
Science, technology, engineering, and manufacturing. You know, people did look at
engineering and mathematics related.
Oh, and mathematics. Excuse me. Some people looked at Omaha. They said, oh, Omaha is where it did work with this creative class effort. They put together a big deal. They bought an entire city block in an industrial corner. They put a $10 million arts complex in place, and they created a club that had an indie rock band, a nonprofit movie house, some film streams. Called Film Streams. So is there an example there? They also had a coffee shop, delicious Blue Line Coffee. Is there an example where city investors saw they had a potential and they were able to energize a whole neighborhood by this one investment?
Well, you know, you can energize a neighborhood. The question is whether or not, you know, the rest of the region should be paying for it. That's an issue that exists. You know, would you be better off putting it into schools or are into your basic infrastructure? Look, I've been to Omaha, and I've spoken to many people in Omaha. What drives Omaha is lower cost, basically lower cost, pretty good education in large areas, and an economy based on business services and obviously the tremendous agricultural base. I mean, I don't think people move to Omaha because it's hip and cool. I think they move to Omaha and then they're pleasantly surprised that they can get a decent meal. But the reason people move to Omaha or businesses are in Omaha is not because they're hip and cool. They're there because, you know, the fundamentals are there. Now, my argument would be that if you go to many places, let's say, I'll give you an example, for instance, Fargo, North Dakota, which you would never expect. 10 years ago, the downtown was pretty dead. Now they've had an economic boom, and you know what? When you have an economic boom, that creates surplus wealth, and some of that wealth will be expressed in better restaurants and better arts. But the idea that arts will turn around the city is pretty, you know, it's pretty peripheral to what's really going on. I mean, Houston, for instance, now has a very thriving art scene, you know, pretty decent museums, excellent restaurants. Well, what causes that is economic growth. So I think what we tend to do is to mistake the fundamentals for the ephemeral. And, of course, that appeals to real estate developers who want to make money on these things. And, of course, it appeals to all the various arts lobbies, which are very powerful in many places because they tend to be run by people who with inherited money.
All right, sir. I appreciate you talking to us. Hope we talk again.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Joel Kotkin is presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University. He recently wrote an article about the creative class model and saying it didn't work. Richard Florida responded saying, oh, it does work, but it does have problems. Let's look at Tacoma. Amy McBride is the arts administrator for the city of Tacoma. She was involved in the project Creative Tacoma when it launched in 2006. Amy McBride, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Now, Richard Florida was his ideas were part of the impetus for Creative Tacoma. Is that right?
Well, Creative Tacoma was one initiative. I'd like to back up a little bit because I would like to say that the city of Tacoma committed to revitalizing the city early on in arts and culture. So they cleaned up the Superfund site that's now our waterfront. They revitalized our theater district. We built three new museums. We started the University of Washington Tacoma, the Tacoma School of the Arts, all of these things before Richard Florida even touched foot in Tacoma. So it was an initiative and a focus that we had going on already. When I started with the city in 1999, I remember they interviewed me and asked me, how are you going to get more artists to come to Tacoma? I said, well, you have my husband and I, we're two more, so you know, we've started it. And since I came to town, we got our Percent for Art funding back, which supports public art. We looked at developing grant programs for individual artists to make sure that we were funding small grassroots things in the neighborhoods, and really working hard to develop an ecosystem where the creative class, before it was even called that, had a place to grow and thrive. So it was really interesting in 2006 when the Chamber of Commerce decided to bring Richard Florida to town. Now, that was a great thing because it was a group of folks outside of the arts and culture who were embracing this and putting investment into it. So at that point, I think the city as a whole had sort of bought into it to some level, but I think the Chamber's commitment to bringing Florida to town helped to bring together a much broader diversity of people to have this conversation. And I think that piece was pivotal, but I think that who we are as a community is an authentic, creative place. We're able to, at least for me, when I remember when the Rise of the Creative Class came out, I read it and I thought, oh, yay, he's speaking to me. You know, I can use some of his language to help to communicate our case to more people. But I think, you know, where I agree with Joel and where I think the problem is that Florida's ideas have been diminished to the idea of a formula or a template. And anytime somebody thinks they can just take a recipe and apply it to their community without being authentic, it's not going to work. You know, so I agree with him on that, but I think that what Florida has to say is a lot deeper, and there are ways that communities can take it to the level that's important to them, that can work, and I think it has been working in Tacoma. And it's not just, you know, equating economic impact. I see it as a really deep and rich community development effort, and it's not just about bringing people to town to come and make it fancy. It's about growing our own folks, creating a place where people want to live and stay and be. And guess what? If we want to be here growing our own businesses and doing cool stuff, maybe other people will think it's good too, and you know, it builds on itself. At least that's my philosophy.
But isn't the question,
it might not be Florida's, but
isn't the question that those people are raising though, Amy McBride, that are critics saying, would that money have been better spent on education, on manufacturing, on math, on science and technology?
Well, it's an ecosystem. It's not one or the other. I mean, that's imagining that there's only that amount of money that's only being spent on one thing and you only have one choice. So I think in the case of the Chamber's investment, the people that they brought together in that room included our current Mayor Strickland, two of our council members. It included our Pierce County prosecutor. It included people from the port. It included all kinds of people that work in all those different areas in education and the libraries and whatnot, and gave us at least a community of our size, which is about 200,000, a shared understanding, at least, whether everybody bought into it or not, but at least a shared understanding of who we are as a community and how we can, you know, really, I think of it as innovation. How can we create a community of innovation? And that has spilled into our school district and our government and our private sector. So it created a thread across which other investment is made, and I think it exponentially helps helps grow as at least our community. And again, it's unique to every place. The other thing that's really interesting about Tacoma, because Joel and I know Richard have both talked about the singles, you know, and I think long ago I noticed that Tacoma was a good place for partnered creatives to be because they could afford to buy a house or raise their kids here. And that was not the case when I first moved here 15 years ago, but it's certainly the case now. And that's a really interesting shift and very different than what, you know, is being talked about. But also now people who have left are coming back. I mean, there was a real brain drain, so to speak, of young people when I first moved here, and that's turning around. So these things that create a vibrant and healthy community are starting to really, really take hold here. And, you know, it's a continuum. Takes a lot of time to make change happen. I mean, the thing that I was worried about with bringing Florida here so specifically is that people would not see something immediate and be able to say, oh, that's just a trend. We already tried that. Forget it. On to the next thing. But again, those are people that are just following trends and not really sinking into what community development means and taking the pieces that are relevant. There are tons of economic development theories that don't work or that, you know, don't work for certain communities. So this is one that people can disregard if they just see it superficially, but it works for our community. And I'm not saying it would work for everyone, but it certainly works for Tacoma.
What impact do you see it downtown, and what impact do you see these efforts out in communities inside Tacoma?
Okay. Well, downtown, that initial investment in the waterfront and whatnot, we can now, we have 6 museums within walking distance of each other. We participated in the Americans for the Arts Economic Prosperity Study 2 times, and the first time we did it in 2005, we showed a $37 million economic impact, and the last time we did it, it was close to $65 million. But the thing that was the most interesting to me in that study was what they look for is the audience spending an impact on and around arts and culture, and the spending of our audiences in Tacoma was close to $30 million. Over twice as much as the spending of other audiences in similar regions, and about 10 million more than the national median, which says to me that even in the darkest times of our recession, our audiences in Tacoma are choosing to spend their money on and around arts and culture. So it isn't just some elitist thing that only fancy people are doing. It's what people in our community embrace and commit their money to. The other thing is, as a city, we have great neighborhoods, and we work very hard to make sure that we're casting the net broadly. We started a program that called SpaceWorks Tacoma a few years back to build creative enterprise. It's the program that Storefront Seattle is based on. And we went into the Hilltop as our best example and seeded small nonprofits that serve youth and urban arts. And they've become the anchor to that neighborhood in the Hilltop where the kids come to learn how to break dance and do spoken word and literacy projects and things like that. And it's really taking hold in that neighborhood. There's a teeny little bar that makes artisan drinks that was written up in the New York Times. And these are these young people that are coming back to Tacoma or choosing to stay in Tacoma that are applying their innovation on the streets, and you're really starting to see it turn around. It's incredible. It's incremental, but it's transformative.
Amy McBride, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Amy McBride is the arts administrator for the city of Tacoma. She's been involved in bringing new ideas and art to Tacoma for more than a decade. This is Weekday.
Speaking of creatives, next hour, the legacy of Bagley Wright, whose philanthropy can be seen everywhere from the Space Needle to the Seattle Repertory Theater to the Seattle Art Museum. We'll do that at 10:15. In the more immediate future, we're going to take a look back at the life and work of acclaimed Nigerian author Chinua Achebe. That's next on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
50 degrees in Seattle, expecting to warm up to 60 this afternoon. Forecast says partly sunny all day.
Support for KUOW comes from West of Lennon, presenting Master Harold and the Boys by playwright Ethel Fugard, set in 1950s apartheid South Africa, about a society that puts a young man at odds with himself. March 27th through April 21st at West of Lennon in Fremont. Details at westoflennon.com.
9:45. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Afghanistan today on a previously unannounced visit, trying to smooth things over with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who's been saying unpleasant things about the U.S. lately. More about that in the news in 15 minutes.
The Nigerian-born novelist Chinua Achebe died last Thursday night. He was 82. In 1958, his novel Things Fall Apart introduced a full-throated, fully voiced African, a colonialized voice, into the world dialogue. Set in the late 19th century, it brings us a protagonist at the crossroads of colonialism. Will he follow the route of traditional culture or step towards the colonial white world of power and promise and wealth? It's a Greek tragedy set amidst the bureaucracy of British colonial rule, and it had impacts on people around the world and continues to have those impacts as well. Charles Mudede is a writer, a thinker. He joins us to talk about the influence Chinua Achebe had on him and the world. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
I remember first coming to his books when I was in high school and have it sort of one of those scales falling off your eyes. We had it compared to Mr. Johnson in a book in a class that I was taking by Joyce Carey. Where did you first read about Chinua Achebe?
By the way, he was very critical of that book.
I know. We're going to get to that.
I was in the British system. I studied in Zimbabwe, but they used the British system for high school, right? And so we had to study our O levels. And there was a section for European literature, a section for American literature. And because the country had become independent from the British around 1980, they had introduced the African literature section, right? And so I selected actually to study European literature and African literature as my subjects. And what they did, which is always interesting, is you had to memorize the novels, right? So they gave you a bunch of novels. You had to memorize them, and then when you tested how they worked, it is that they gave you. My memory says they gave you a sentence, right, from the novel, and then you had to reconstruct from that sentence. You know, who said it? If it was somebody saying something, what the context was, right? What the tension was, and where it was in the novel, right? And this sort of thing. So you just received a sheet of paper with just a sentence or maybe two, but I just say, as I said, a sentence. And so one of my novels was Things Fall Apart. So I memorized it from beginning to end.
Really?
Yeah. I memorized it. And it was not a difficult thing to do. I mean, I loved the book.
But this is 80s, right? Early 80s.
Early 80s, yeah, around mid-80s, 1985. And so there it appeared on the paper that I received for my exam, just a few words, and I reconstructed the whole novel in an essay.
All right, in terms of influences and stuff, right. Heart of Darkness, he railed against Heart of Darkness because he said it was racist, and it just perpetuated this notion of the oppressed and the silent. And Mr. Johnson, he said that he and his fellow classmates got that book when they were going to school in the 50s, and they thought, well, this guy's an idiot. A nitwit is the phrase he used. What did his writing do? What did his writing do for people in Africa?
Well, okay, I got to tell you something. Africa is a really big place.
I know.
Right. That's the first thing. And so
when Nigeria is a big country.
It's a big country and lots of people. And it's the most populous country in Africa. And with several civilizations contained in it, right? And religions and all that stuff. I mean, it's a mixed place, right? So here's the thing with Chinua Achebe. I read Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad in high school as well. Now, I was raised in Zimbabwe, and the geography is savanna. It's grassland, right? So you read, I remember Zaire had changed to Congo had, you know, was initially the name of the country. It's back to Congo now, but there was this moment when Mobutu ran the country, right, that was called Zaire, right? That was the sort of the name for it, and then and now it's back to Congo. So I did not know where the Congo was, right? I just knew Zaire. So I read thing. I read Heart of Darkness, right? And it describes these trees that are as big as kings, right? These thick jungles, right? And, you know, the sun is sickly and all this sort of stuff. And this, I look out my window, I've never seen anything like this in Zimbabwe, right? So when I read this novel, I thought it was happening somewhere in South America. I'm not kidding you. It just did not make, it was like reading something from outer space, right? That's how big Africa is.
There's, was for me.
That's right. And so when I read that Chinua Achebe was attacking it, the reason that he said was really strange also. He said he didn't like that novel because, and the reason why he even wrote his novel, the Things Fall Apart, is because he said, you know, they were using these derogatory terms in the novel about the blacks who were just suffering on the banks of the river, right? They didn't say anything really. The whole novel in it's 70 pages, but the only word an African says basically in the whole novel is "Kurtz, he dead." Right? That's it. That's the only thing an African says in an entire novel that's set in Africa. And so he said to himself, right, I want to write a novel that finally locates or brings to the foreground those people who say nothing in that novella. Now, I was of the opinion, and I didn't, so when I read Things Fall Apart, I was surprised to learn that those were Africans. that were being bombarded by the vessel.
Well, he wrote, Conrad relegated Africa to the role of props for the breakup of one petty European mind.
Yeah,
he is it fair to do that with Conrad or Carey?
You know, Carey deserves it. Carey's just a bad novel. I mean,
Mr.
Johnson's a bad novel. I just thought that was he was fighting something.
It was boring.
Second rate. Yeah, that was second rate literature. But Conrad is first rate literature, and I thought that was the real challenge that he was proposing, a real shift in English literature, right? How we consider one of the canonical texts, right, and one that's beloved. I mean, you got to remember, Heart of Darkness is considered to be sympathetic. It's not considered, right, entirely racist. It's a book which attacks British capitalists and European capitalists, right, processes, I don't want to give the Marxist term, but it's sort of this robbery. Right, but before you have a market, you just have a robbery. Right, that's what we say, and this is the robber stage of the capitalist process, and that's what he's describing in that book, and he's criticizing it. And this is at the turn of the century. But I must say, I was not completely convinced with Achebe's argument, and it's in a famous essay. Right, he wrote an essay, but I thought that it was a great attack, but I always felt that there was something that he should have. The story was a little more interesting than he pictured.
Charles Madede is a writer, a filmmaker. Are you still associate editor for The Stranger?
Yes, I am.
And also a lecturer at humanities at Pacific Lutheran University. He's a screenwriter. His work has appeared in New York Times, Village Voice, LA Weekly. All right, here's something I want you to react to then. This is what Achebe said. His desire was to find a balance of stories where every people – well, this is what it was said about him – but he also, this is paraphrasing, every people would be able to contribute to a definition of themselves where we're not victims of other people's accounts. Did he do that?
You know, yes. And the first thing is, the big question in African literature is something didactic, right, or not? This is sort of the thing they sort of teach you in college, right? And you couldn't say, in a sense, you can't say that his novels are didactic, right? I think they're just too complicated. In fact, you have to remember the Things Fall Apart. The hero is not simple, right? He's not,
yeah.
Right? He's not a sort of African warrior who goes in and solves the problem of European colonial, right, arrival, right? He doesn't do it. He actually fails, and he makes a mess of it. And in fact, you have strange sympathy for his son, who sort of does convert to Christianity, and you realize that he comes from a world which had lots of problems. And so in a sense, I mean, this is a book he wrote at 28,
yeah.
And the richness of it, right, is astounding. So to me, no, he doesn't give anybody an easy way out of the problem, and I think that's what I think.
You know, he wrote so the last novel he wrote was 87, after a long time.
Right, right.
Ant Hills of the Savannah.
Yes.
Those three characters,
yeah,
which were all dealing with revolution and coups in Nigeria, a media person, a political person, and a military person.
Right.
all come to bad ends.
Yes.
Complicated people that come to bad ends.
Yes.
I mean, he is not giving the world any sort of pass in that sense.
Yeah, he's not giving Africa that any kind of pass. And this is maybe the real thing. You have to see the last novel really as attempt to. So yeah, the first two are about, the first one, of course, is just about the encounter with Europeans, right? The second one deals with what they call, there's a whole study in, you know, Franz Fanon school where they talk about the sort of the betrayal, the great betrayal, right? The Africans go to war against the Europeans, they win, they establish statehood, and then they have a leader who betrays. Right? And this is what No Longer at Ease is about, right? And so No Longer at Ease, the character, follows, you know, is corrupt. He accepts bribes and that sort of thing. And this is the stage. I'm sorry. This is the world that, if you look, the last dictator in Africa, which is Robert Mugabe, that's the world it comes from, right? They take bribes and so on and so on. So the question was, and I don't think Achebe actually succeeded in trying to imagine how we come out of those two moments, the pre-colonial, the post-colonial. And so there are novels out there that I think did a sort of attempt to resolve the problems, but I don't think that we've had a novel yet, in at least in the English tradition, that has supplied a vision that is after No Longer at Ease,
because we're still struggling.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of different things, right? And so we're beyond post-colonial picture of the great betrayal of the dictators, right? Basically. Mugabe is like, what, 90 years old, right? And so we're just waiting for that to pass by. And then who knows what happened.
Nadine Gordimer said that he was a writer who has no illusions but is not disillusioned. And of course, he wrote a number of nonfiction. He wrote essays about Biafra. He wrote essays about when he won the Man Booker International Prize, Home in Exile, right? He'd written about those autobiographical essays. I want to end with this, though. How do you, as somebody who is part of the great diaspora, which we all are part of,
right.
How do you put your writing today, tracing it back to somebody like Achebe or any of the writers that were sort of in the colonial times, broke the colonial times?
Right. Okay. Let me tell you something. There's a guy called Alfred Whitehead. He's a British philosopher in the early part of the 20th century. Right. And he had a famous comment. He said every piece of philosophy written, right, up to his point, right, Hegel and all this stuff, is a footnote on Plato. Right. And so you get where I'm going with this. Everything that's been written in African literature since Things Fall Apart is practically a footnote on that book.
Is that right?
That's every comment, every idea that has attempted to explain the African condition, right? We live in the ghost of those characters, right?
You've read Chris Abani.
Yes, I have. In fact, I would say that maybe his novel, the one he wrote with about Nigeria, about Lagos, the first one, Graceland, that may be the first real. I'm glad you brought that up. That might be the first novel, I think, that attempts to capture the post-colonial. The post-colonial, right?
Well, how do you see your writing?
You're a
filmmaker. You wrote a film about this area.
Yeah. No, I think that one thing you can break up African literature into three parts. I'm going to be very simple about this. That's right.
Yeah. Right? 40 seconds.
You have pre-colonial moment. Then you have the European moment, right? The post-colonial moment, and then you're now in the American moment. And I think that I'm still in the American moment, and then possibly with the new changes going on in Africa, we'll be talking about a Chinese moment, right?
Whoa.
So
in the arts, in the literature.
In the literature, yeah. Yeah, because Africa is not isolated. It's connected to the global flows of money and influences and so forth and so on.
And so today the influence is coming from China, and that's
it's growing. That's for sure, and everybody's talking about it. And it's I'm reading a lot about what economists and cultural figures think about this growing presence of Chinese capital in Africa. But it is this next moment. But for a while, America was the big issue, and America was in Africa in the sense of a big cultural figure, not economics, but as in terms of music, from James Brown to Fela Kuti and all these things, right? There was a massive impact that the U.S. had, and I call that the American moment. And you find that in Chris Abeni's novel. If you look at it, it's really about, you know, the kid is a Elvis Presley impersonator, right? And that's very different from, say, the colonial British kind of character, like Mr. Johnson, right? Who imitates what? He imitates the civil servant.
He was a nitwit.
Yes.
Charles Wudede, remembering the novelist Chinua Achebe. I hope you will come back again.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Mine too. This is Weekday.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. Looks like a bailout for Cyprus could mean future trouble. Where will it all end? The latest on the financial crisis in Cyprus in the news in a moment. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Athena Health, helping physicians manage industry change so they can focus on patient care. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.